to the Combat Morale podcast. On today's programme, I have the privilege of speaking to Max Lorca and Antonio Garcia about their collaborative work, a book detailing Max's experience as a Swedish Special Operations soldier deployed as part of the Swedish contribution to the International Security Assurance Force, ISAF, in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2014, and later the Resolute Support Mission until 2021. Max, a soldier and a ranger specialising in reconnaissance, intelligence and covert operations, shares his journey through this autobiography of his time in uniform. Our conversation today delves into the motivations that drove Max and his comrades to enlist, serve and engage in combat during their operational deployments.
So before we start, a quick disclaimer. The views and the discussion that follows is that of the participants and does not represent the views of any government or military. With that out of the way, gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. Could you start by introducing yourselves and how you came to do this collaboration on this book?
Yeah, I can start. My name is Max, Max Lauker, and I'm from Sweden. I'm almost 45 years old, and I joined the Swedish Army in 2001, so that was quite some time ago, and I had a journey, just like Tony, in the Army, and I went to South Africa in 2008, and then I met a colleague to Tony. And years after that, you know, just like 2020, maybe, was it 2020, Tony?
Yeah.
We got together.
It's all the years just merge into one, Max. So, you know, I'm just like, you know, it's been a couple of years. But as Max says, yeah, mutual friend, and you know, that's how we started this journey.
Yeah, so, and I think that when I met Tony, I was introduced to Tony by this mutual friend. He was a major back then in the South African Defense Forces, and now he's a colonel or something like that. So he has he's done well. But he said we talked on and off, and he said he has always been pushing me to write something about my military experiences. And then I said, yeah, that's going to be rough because, I mean, I don't know where to start, blah, 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 blah. And then he said, there back in 2020, he said, yeah, but you should call this guy. Just call him, see what he has to say, and maybe he can help you out. And, you know, and from a week later, we had a book contract. So, yeah, it was quick and nice, quick and dirty.
I mean, that's how we roll. So, yeah, I think that was it. Yeah, so our mutual friend, we went on a mission together years back. I think that was 2010. And then, you know what it's like, military kind of fraternity and all that. So I had been hearing about Max for years. And then I knew that our colleague was pushing this. He's very much into kind of modern military history. And that's when, after me and Max spoke, we were like, obviously my interest was just to learn a bit more and, you know, to see what I could do in help guiding the process. But of course, you know, Max is the primary author, you know, it's all him. It's all his story. I mean, you know, I couldn't do anything close to what's in this book. How about that for a hook, Tom?
That's great. Now, I think, Max, for our audience unfamiliar with the Swedish military and Swedish military operations, can you provide some background on the name, history, size and function of Sweden's special forces?
Okay, I'm going to try to keep it short. But so, I mean, Sweden, like any other small country, we are currently, we're what, like 10 million people. So the army has always been on a, you know, on the smaller side, but it has been quite effective because we have had this compulsory military system that everybody does it, you know, for a while. And, you know, when they're 18, they get the call to muster, they spend, what, 10, 15, 20 months in the army, and then they crack on with their civilian lives. So we had in the 80s, we had what, a million people that we could, you know, master if we had to. So, but of course, like with a country that size, your special forces is also going to be, substantially smaller than we see in the UK or what in India or the United States. But of course, we always had it in some shape or form, even, you know, since ancient times, you have intelligence, you have spies, you have mercenaries on a high level. But in the modern setting, I think, like when we started to roll over, you know, after the Cold War, late 90s, we still had an army that was set for invasion. We didn't have anything, you know, really that special. We had a bit of anti-terrorist forces, of course. We had intelligence, we had you know, the spies, all of that. But that's a quite, you know, it's a very, very sharp, it's the sharpest end of the knife, and it's very tiny. So I think we saw in the early 2000s, 2000, 2001, you saw the development in Afghanistan. We had started to de-mechanize the army in 1998 already, because it was too heavy. It was, you know, nobody was going to come and invade by land anymore. The tanks were dismantled. And we Sweden wanted to be more flexible, more agile, have a shorter but more sharper sword, so to speak. And that's when it started. And it started in 2001, 2000. But at that point, you just took a handful of good officers and a handful of good men from the Ranger regiments. We're talking about a platoon size, maybe, that started to form this experimental SSG, the Special Protection Group. And that was just handpicked officers with no special training. They were just, you know, very, very good and forward officers from different Ranger regiments, from the Arctic Rangers, from the paratroopers, from, you know, different disciplines. And they put them together and said, yeah, we need to make something. We need to start make, you know, something that can last, that we can build them some umbrella, etc. So they did that. And at the same time, we had another group at the Paris, a group of officers that has been called the Paratroopers Rapid Reaction Company. So it was almost on a voluntary basis. They just gathered a bunch of officers to you know, if something happens, we need to have something. And the paratroopers in Sweden, they are good at reconnaissance. And so that was their discipline. And so they kind of got together with this experimental SSG, Special Protection Group unit, that was a more offensive. You know, they wanted to do counter-terrorist things. They wanted to do, I don't know, high-profile, close protection. They were things like that. And they said, let's merge, or let's try to merge and see what happens. But it couldn't happen because there was no format. There's never been up until that point, there was no format in Sweden to have special. Who's going to run them? Who are they going to run under? Who's going to command them? Where are they going to be? What kind of equipment, blah, blah, blah. So it was, you know, starting from scratch. So it ended up with being two different paths. The FES, IK, the paratroopers, they went to become something that's called SIG, the Special Intelligence Group, or a Special Information Group, or something like that. And then we had SSG, that was the, you know, the action part of it. And it kind of ran like this. And you can see, like, in 2003, we had the first operation overseas by the reconnaissance component, SIG. They participated in Artemis, the French-led operation in Africa. And that was kind of the first, you know, first real action that they saw. And at the same time, the government had started to formalize this, that we needed this special forces, you know, and it had to become, you know, we had to set the plate for it. We had to set the template, the framework for it. And so the special forces, I think it's hard to say exactly when it started, but I mean, the history book says late 90s, 2000, 2001, but I would say around 2002 or 3, we have a formalized unit that's called the Special Protection Group. And they became the special forces, and the SIG, which was their reconnaissance component, they were just tagging along because they were not included at that. So that's when it really started. And that's when you have an official command, you have an official base, you have an official, some kind of, you know, recruiting component put to part, you know, how we're going to feed this machine with people. And so that's how it started, basically. And I think that the development that came out of that, because we had Afghanistan on the horizon, right? It was coming up in the early 2000s. And that is also because we want to be playing ball with the big guys. We need to provide something for the NATO coalition so they can see that we are on board. And for that, you know, that purpose, we also need to really speed up the development of the special forces, because there is no going back from there. We need more and more special forces. And so I think it's around there, 2002, 2003, and then it just skyrocketed. And now it's quite a big, extensive part of the Swedish armed forces.
I wonder whether you could shed some light on the selection process and the training that people go through to join the special forces, and what is their strategic and tactical role within the broader Swedish defence makeup?
I mean, if we look at it today, because the selection, of course, it was very different back in the day. But if we look at it from 2024's perspective, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's been based on all other, it's like every other special forces selection out there. It's about 2 weeks. First of all, you have to kind of, they don't have a cap. So you don't have to be Ranger qualified. You don't have to be absolutely anything. You just, you know, fill in your application, send it in. You know, when you come to this elections, you meet anyone, you know, you have a guy from the Navy that drives a submarine, and he has never packed a backpack, basically. And you have a guy from the Arctic Rangers side by side. And that's because they want to have this, you know, they want to have as much competence in this circle as they can. So they don't exclude people. And they also very, I think the difference with the Swedish Special Forces selection is that they're very kind, because they will assess you, you know, are based on your future capabilities, not so much because, of course, if you come from the Navy, you drive boats, you're going to be an asset. And if you're a good Navy man, you're going to be an asset. And maybe you're not in the same physical shape as somebody that's been an Arctic Ranger for 5 years. So they're very kind like that. And I think because they want to be inclusive, they want to have people from, you know, they want to have technicians, they want to have mechanics, and they understand that they need to adjust for them. It's not all about physical capabilities. And I think that has changed a bit, because when I was starting, when I did it, it was more or less about, you know, oh, you didn't run this fast, you're out. You didn't lift this much, you're out. But that has changed. And I think that's important to have a dynamic and very inclusive, because you can see, like you see today in Ukraine, like how many technicians, drone guys, computer guys you need. You need quite a lot. Do they need to be able to run 10 kilometers and this and that time? Of course they don't. So I think they've been good with that. So the selection is fairly, I mean, it's straightforward. It's 2 weeks. You have a formal part, which is 1 week now. And then you have a field part, which is 1 week, one and a half, two. It can vary a bit. And the formal one, it's just, you know, it's just theory, exams, physical stuff. And then the field part is when they weed people out and see how they work together under pressure. And then after that, it follows with, it's also different, but it's between 15 and 24 months of training to become an operator. And then you become operational. So, and the role has also changed, because when it started early on, it was mostly about support, you know, providing, you know, like maybe they do in Ukraine today, like what we have done in Afghanistan today, mentoring, support, and that kind of role. Now it's, of course, we have grown in size, they have grown in size. And now it's, I would say they are working more on a tactical level and has moved away from the strategic level a bit since, you know, this has grown now. It's not just this, it's called SOG, the Special Operations Group, that's the umbrella. And we have the reconnaissance component, the action component, we have intelligence component, we have support, flight wing, Navy. So it's pretty big now. So I think they are more like a tactical unit that you use today than a strategical unit that we had it like before.
So let's turn to your experience in the Swedish Special Forces. What were the driving motivations for your decision to join them?
I mean, it was mostly, I wanted to become an officer first. I started training as an Arctic Ranger. That was my basic training. I was selected for officers training after that. We had a massive cutbacks in the Swedish Armed Forces. So the officers training that year was canceled. And I was offered a position, not in the Special Forces, but in a in a different unit that was, you know, it's an ad hoc kind of contract, half gray area special forces unit. They call it special purpose units, or they did then. And that was my entry into this. And I served there for till 2008, and then I did the formal move to the special forces, and I did the selection and the training. But I was already halfway in, because that was, we were in some kind of gray area. Maybe we're supporting special forces. Maybe we are special forces. Nobody knew back then. It was early days. But we're definitely, I would say that the special purpose units that I, there were a few of them, and I belonged to one, that they were definitely part of the development of the special forces, since there was nothing formalized. Everybody was just trying to do something, you know, find a niche that they could survive in when the army is cutting down.
I think... Max, if I, Tom, if you don't mind, if I just come in from the book, something that comes out very strongly from the book number 788 is Max's motivation. You know, so it's a bit of a coming of age story, in the sense that, you know, we've all, for maybe for us on the call, been a 17, 18 year old boy. What do you do next? You know, is this path for me or that path? And that comes out in the story, and how he overcame these challenges, and they're quite significant. And then he frames it really well, you know, in terms of that, how he says it's really, you know, it's said really nicely, the regimental death, it, even though it's a bit macabre, but it really frames the time and you know, the cutbacks post-Cold War, et cetera. Maybe now we're thinking a different thing, you know, in terms of conventional war after 2022. But going back to that, and it really gives great detail, you know, like for me, I was never there, but, you know, I could share, you know, in framing the narrative, and Max puts a lot of detail into that selection process, and really how the he says an improvised nature, and also a word that I remember that stands out, it was the embryo of the modern or the current special forces, and how they in fact developed that over time, and really it was a closely run thing. I mean, it you know, in some of the chapters you'll see how he goes into the detail of, it was really the lower level initiative of people in the unit putting their own money on the line, you know, convincing generals and colonels, hey, listen, if we do this, we can get that. And of course, part of it was that venture, but part of it was that they wanted to keep their jobs. So, you know, just bringing in a bit from, you know, from how it was framed in the book, you know. But yeah, I just wanted to add that piece.
Yeah, and I think that exactly, Tony, that was the motivation. So if I get back to that, the motivation was not, oh, I want to join the special forces, I want to do this and that. It's like, yeah, do you want to still be, you know, do you want to be part of the armed forces, or do you want to, you know, try this new thing with us? So I think there was no deeper motivation for me. I had nothing to do with. I wanted to be in this environment for a bit longer, and that was the motivation.
So. Let's talk about sort of active service. Now, in the realm of motivation within the special forces, can you elaborate on the various factors at play that motivate individuals in the units, such as professionalism or masculinity, cohesion, nationalism, or loyalty to the unit? And furthermore, are there any sort of differences in the motivational drivers between special forces personnel and those serving in regular Swedish armed forces units?
That's a good question. And I think when to look at this question, you have to look at it from a Swedish perspective. We have not been a warrior nation for quite some time. And, you know, the army's role, it altogether has been very toned down. You know, it's just something that is in the background. It's not like the Americans or the British or people that have had people that fought for something and made a difference. And we really never had that, because we just, you know, we just slided through World War II, and since then we haven't had any problems. And the army has always been not a motivation for people. It's something that, you know, you have to do it. You don't stay. I mean, it's a low level job, basically. Don't stay in the army. Do it. Do your duty, and then you crack on. So, I think the motivation altogether has been really low. And if you look at it from a socioeconomic standpoint, I think, as in many countries, unfortunately, but there's a lot of people with lesser education and less future possibilities that has gone into the chosen the army path. And back in that day, the motivation, and especially when we come to operational aspects, at least from a Swedish standpoint, it has very, I mean, yes, if you go back and take the regular UN missions, you know, under UN flag in Bosnia, Kosovo, we have done Lebanon, Suez, Congo. I mean, during, we have always been a, Sweden has always participated on a high level in United States kind of run missions, but that's a different thing because then people, you know, it's not professional soldiers. They have made their service. They come in from the street and they say, okay, let's go and help. There we have one motivation for the helping part. When we come to the special forces, when they were very young, there was no motivation like helping. You want to play ball, you know, you're a fireman, you want it to burn a bit. And unfortunately, but that's the state where you're at when you have never done it. Nobody has been in combat. Combat experience was very scarce in the Swedish Armed Forces altogether. So the main focus for the individuals was combat. And if we look to Afghanistan, for example, I have never met any Swedish soldier that came there to help. It's like, yeah, I mean, as their primary motivation. It's not for the nationalism. It's not for the nation. It's not for the king. Because there is nothing there for you to touch. Nobody knows why are we in Afghanistan. No, there is no connection for that. Because the Swedish government, they said, yeah, we're going to send some troops. Yeah, for what? And then the primary motivation becomes actually to get this experience, combat experience. And I would say that this differentiates it from the Swedish regular army. Because I think that's more of a duty kind of, you know, motivation. You're going to do your duty. You're going to do this. Everybody has done it before you. That's so it's pretty cut and dry. But when it comes to special forces, it has always been the combat part, not maybe. And I'm not saying it's not like this sinister kind of vibe, like, yeah, we're gonna go down to kill. We don't want to help. Of course, people want to help, but that's hard. It's hard for every soldier. You can ask any soldier that's been even from, you know, UK, if you United States, when you come down to Iraq, Afghanistan, why are you there? I'm there because my buddies are there. And we're here together and we are going to survive. That is the motivation for most people, I think, when it comes to that. It's different now. But now we joined NATO. We have like this newborn kind of army, you know, festive vibe. Everything is about army now. And we have an active threat that people can see, almost touch. So now I think it's more out of, you want to help your country, you want to protect, be a part of that. But that was never an issue, has never been an issue for a long time up until now. So I think, of course, it's different today. But back in the day, it was mostly for experience, and because that is what you should do. I mean, you should go there. If your buddies went, you also go. That's about that.
I think a lot of the studies show that, Tom, that, you know, when people speak about who do you fight for, you know, kind of the, you know, and I'm sure poems have been written about it and all that, you know, the grandeur of it all, you know, king and country or a greater good, or and Max touches on that in the book also, you know, it becomes a little bit philosophical, but on the ground it would be the person next to you. And I think that's the experience, you know, for time immemorial for soldiers. And one of the pieces, you know, that stands out for me from what Max writes, or, you know, one of the chapters that's put together about the cohesion part, and you mentioned about professionalism, and it involves one of one of the figures in there was called Captain B. And he speaks a lot about professionalism and how that's drilled into the team, you know, working in small teams. And, you know, I think Max can tell the story better, but it involves how, you know, how I think it's actually brilliant, you know, this part. And basically he takes everyone and he says to them, here's a contract, you know, forget about your contract you've signed with the military or the Swedish Defense Force. Here's a contract for us as a unit. And I think it's absolutely brilliant, you know, that they've already trained so hard. And, you know, they, of course, see him as the leader. And this kind of cements that, you know, and it certainly makes, just as the, you know, as someone that was helping frame the story, you know, I could kind of just imagine what it would be. But I'm not sure, Max, how you felt in that moment. But, you know, from what I read in the piece with you, it was certainly a bonding moment.
Definitely, it was a bonding moment. And I think it was quite a unique moment in my career, because this guy, he was a new officer at the Arctic Ranger Regiment. He came from a different Arctic Ranger Regiment that was put down, and he was old school, but he was also very progressive and dynamic in this. He wanted to have a personal contract with us, and exactly like Tony said, the bonding, and that he was also, you know, it was not just between that we were going to answer to him, he was also going to answer to us. And I think that is important. And of course, with that kind of thing, I mean, you don't need any other motivation after that, really. What else are they going to, you know, what else can motivate you? So you're just going to go with this contract. You're going to go with the professionalism. You're going to go where your buddies go. And of course, you know, you're going to seek the excitement a bit.
But were there any women in the Swedish Special Forces, and that did that influence and shape the motivation and morale of units?
No, it is a good question. And I think it's more important than, you know, it has never been more important than now. It's very, you know, it's something that I think armed forces everywhere is working with this, you know, the gender perspective of things. But back in those days, no, there was no women. I mean, we didn't have women in Ranger regiments. There were experiments when I did it. You know, they tried. It's always about this. It comes down to physical capabilities. But this side kind of gig, or the side unit of the main special forces at the time, this SIG, which was the reconnaissance component, they understood early on, you know, we have to have women on board, because, I mean, women can move in different places, especially in the Middle East, in different places than men. They can listen into different discussions than men. And, I mean, of course, we need women. So they were early on, and they did something. They had this also very dynamic and adaptive recruiting process, because this is always the core discussion when it comes to women. They are not as strong, they are not as fast, blah, blah, blah. But I think that they are. It's just exponential, because, you know, men have more muscle mass from the get-go. So the requirements are a bit... I mean, the Israelis, they understood it early on. I mean, they have understood that women have a place. Then they have done this thing that when they separate them in different regiments and units, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, of course, so we have had women from the get-go, and we have them now. I would say that it's maybe 25% are women today, all over the Special Forces spectrum. And they're also, you know, lightening up the rules and requirements for Ranger units, because it has been proven they have worked extremely well. And it's mostly mindset, because I remember it even today, because 1 year after basic training, they had these experiments. They took, you know, these highly qualified women that volunteered to make this experiment. And the thing that shocked me was that most men, they just didn't like it because they were women. And that's an attitude that in the Swedish Army, they've been quite good working with that on all levels. But it's firstly now you can see the results of that, because it took, what, 10, 15 years to have some kind of acceptance for women in Ranger, you know, capacity or Ranger roles or Special Forces roles. I mean, of course, it's very important to have women. I mean, you can't function without them. And especially in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, they're very important. You can't have any kind of humming outreach work without women. It's just impossible.
In light of recent allegations against certain Special Forces units in Afghanistan for unlawful killings and war crimes, how did Swedish leaders and military institutions ensure that the motivation and the morale did not lead to actions outside the rules of war?
I think that comes down to professionalism. That is what it comes down to at the end of the day. But I mean, one has to understand, to control a Special Forces environment, especially in a war zone, it is difficult, because there is a very, very fine and thin line what you can and cannot do. You know, it's like you're an inch from murder or you're a hero. So I think it's always hard to balance that, because it comes down to mostly to public opinion. Because I think most armed forces are good at staying within the limits, but then the limits are, you know, decided basically, or they're made on, you know, from popular opinion. If it, you know, if you do well enough in a war and everybody's happy with that, they will give you a longer leash. If everybody's unhappy, you will have a very short. So, I mean, it can be anything, you know, you're pushing a prisoner or somebody that you have apprehended. That can be a big thing, even if it's quite normal. But, or you can, you know, you can raid the wrong house, and that's okay because you're successful in what you're doing. But I think the important part is professionalism and to talk about it, because you have to be grounded. As the most important part is that the soldiers are grounded, that they know at least what they're doing there, because they don't have to like what they're doing there, but they have to know what they're doing and what they are achieving with it, and kind of make their own peace with how far that you can go. Because at the end of the day, it's the people on the ground that will have to make the tough decisions. And I think in Sweden, we've always been good at, because we don't have this strict hierarchy. We have a, you know, even as a squad leader, you will have a very long leash to make your own decisions, to make your own, you know, make it your own mission. You just get, you know, the direction and the purpose, and then you can make it your own. And I think that is always better than to force a mission onto somebody and how they should do it. And because that's when problems occur. That's when you're going to get problems, because you can't do it your way. And you don't understand within yourself, what are the limits of this? How far can we go?
And finally, gentlemen, where can people get the book and learn more about Max's experiences?
I think that's a Tony question. That's a very good Tony question.
Well, fair enough. So it's being published with Hillian. So it's coming out in September, and it's available from all good stores and good bookstores, and also from Amazon. And yeah, you know, it's all I can say. It's been a hell of an experience to co-write it, just in the sense of being a supporting author. And, you know, there are many interesting parts that come out from it, Tom. So, you know, like even things working with Rush, you know, as Max mentioned, the improvised nature of, I can't even say it was training, because it was really being thrust into live operations, protecting Russian oligarchs, for example, being deployed and infiltrating terrorist groups in France. You know, and so all of this is part of that narrative. And, you know, how Max used, you know, savvy, and you mentioned earlier, it's not always about strength, but really that mental agility, and how you can get around certain things, figure out what people want, and build that confidence. You know, that's more on the espionage side, but that really does come through. There's really a lot in this book, you know, and so those are some of the pieces that you know, the readers can look forward to in the book.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for that, and I look forward to seeing it on Netflix sometime in the near future.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom.